Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're live in Denver, Colorado at the Bonneville stations. I'm here with John Bissett and Brad Hart, and we're going to have a great time. You stick around.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, saving, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twert. And by the Telos Alliance, shaping the future of audio, inspiring you to create the most exciting and engaging audio experiences imaginable. Visit telosalliance.com/opt-in.
Hey friends, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, way over here on the left side of your television screen. And we are live in Denver, Colorado today doing This Week in Radio Tech. I'll introduce our guests here in just a minute. This is the show where we talk about everything from somebody else's microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the stuff in between. Digital, analog, music, faders, old technology, new technology. We have a good time talking about these things and sharing stories and importantly, sharing ideas about how to do a better job of broadcast engineering. If you're new to the show, glad you're here. Go back and watch some older shows, learn some things about the fundamentals of broadcasting. Almost every week I hear from somebody in somewhere in Africa or somewhere in India or in Australia or in the Southeast Asia asking about, hey, I'm new to broadcast engineering. What can I do to learn? Well, you found the right place and we're glad you're here. And for us old timers, we just have a good time. We talk about the things we did last week, what we had for breakfast and sometimes some real engineering things too. All right. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance and we do this podcast every week. With me is my colleague here, John Bissett, and he's been with us before, also works at Telos, and he's also the author of the Workbench column in Radio World magazine. Hey, welcome in.
Thanks so much, Kirk.
And you have to get on microphone there somehow.
Well, we're really glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Awesome. I'm glad you're here. And we'll talk a little bit about what we were doing in this area in just a minute. Also, we have with us Mr. Brad Hart. Hey, Brad, welcome in.
Hey, Kirk. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's good to see you. I haven't seen you in Denver in a long time.
Been a while.
I remember when I met you and I had, I think, an Omnia audio processor under my arm.
You did.
And I don't remember if you looked skeptical or excited or maybe both.
Well, I was probably both. And then, of course, after I put it in, I was very excited.
Oh, good.
So
okay.
That was good.
Okay.
Oh,
awesome.
Story. Good thing.
Awesome. Good deal. Yeah. Good deal. Well, our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by three terrific sponsors, the Telos Alliance, also Broadcasters General Store, and this week in cooperation with Henry Engineering, and also from Lavo. So we're going to talk about our first sponsor right now, the Telos Alliance, and the VX Voice over IP Multi-Studio VoIP Engine and VoIP Gateway. It's an amazing product. And so this VX, describe to you briefly what it does. It is the ideal thing for broadcasters with 2, 3, 4, or 20 studios to put callers on the air, to bring in live remotes, to get actualities from newsmakers, from reporters. You can use it for ordinary telephone calls and even for HD voice calls. There's a way to do that that's pretty exciting. And there's a lot of VX phone systems out there for broadcasters, both at radio stations and at TV stations, and even at some non-traditional facilities as well. Well, here we are at the facilities of Bonneville International in Denver, Colorado. And at Bonneville here, I'll just ask Brad, you've been using an older Telos phone system for a long time. What is that?
The old reliable 2101.
I'm glad you said reliable.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
good.
Absolutely.
And that, but
it's
that
bulletproof.
Now that uses PRI technology, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you bring PRI phone lines in, and then it distributes your phone calls to the rooms that you want it to, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, in a lot of markets, the cost of PRI has gone way up. I don't know if it has here or not, but you sound like from talking to you earlier, you're going to move your phones, your broadcast phones, to a newer model,
yes.
Newer technology.
Yep. VX2 is on the agenda for later this year. And, looking forward to it. We've been extremely happy with, the 2101 served us well, but it's time to move on to newer technology and get going on that.
So, I know that a number of broadcasters have switched. First of all, maybe their 2101 or whatever they were using was getting long in the tooth. But for a lot of broadcasters, the cost of their traditional ISDN, PRI, or BRI lines has gone way up. Are you looking at saving some money with VoIP or about the same cost, or will you continue using your PRI lines?
I think at this point, you know, Kirk, we're gonna continue to use, you know, PRI, but we're still talking to Joe Mock a little bit about, you know, a couple of options. So we, thankfully, here in this facility, we've got several options we can choose from.
And this is kind of cool with Telus VX and VoiceOver IP. You, the customer, you, the broadcast engineer, you can choose the level of reliability, the quality, and the price point of bringing phone service in. You know, it used to be the only choice you had was POTS or ISDN from your phone provider, whoever that incumbent phone provider was. And now you've got choices for bringing VoIP in, either through a managed VoIP service, which will typically be on fiber, or managed copper or coax. But you can also have an externally hosted PBX. And for example, my little radio stations in Mississippi and Arkansas and in Hawaii, we do exactly that. We use an external PBX host. It happens to be here in Denver, Colorado. So actually, at my 14 radio stations, every time we pick up the phone, put a caller on the air, or make a business call, our voice goes through Denver, Colorado. How about that? and it's as reliable as our internet service is at our radio facilities, which it's mostly reliable. Sure, we're in small towns, so once in a while we have an outage, but it's getting more reliable all the time. I can attest to that. Now, what does that mean for you? Well, if you want to put a Telus VX system in, what you're going to find is a facility-wide savings on doing it. We used to think of phone systems as being studio by studio. We'd buy, you know, a phone system for this studio, and maybe next year we'd budget a phone system for another control room or production room, or maybe a new set of phones for the newsroom. Well, it's different now. Now, if you replace all your broadcast phones and hybrids with a VoIP-based system called the Telus VX, you can get the cost per studio way down and improve the quality at the same time. And it's possible to save a lot of money by moving to a VoIP service, whether it's managed or whether it's just comes in over your internet. I don't recommend that for everybody, but for some people it works fine. And it's really the way to go to get you into the best audio quality, the lowest cost, and the most flexibility. So if you would, check out the Telus VX. Go to telusalliance.com and look under Telus. Look for broadcast phone systems, and you'll find the Telus VX. There's a picture of it right there. There's lots of videos about the Telus VX, how quickly it goes together, how it's easy to put together, and some ideas, some white papers and other ideas about getting a good return on investment from it.
I was going to say, Kirk, yeah, that's one of the points. It's really pretty neat.
Yeah.
I've had several customers that have converted from POTS lines to SIP lines and the VX. They've paid for their VX system in a year to a year and a half in just the POTS savings. So if you're looking to save some money, tell that to your general manager. He'll be very pleased.
Thanks a lot to the Telus Alliance. Thank you, John. Thank you, Brad, for talking about the Telus VX. And by the way, there is also the VX Prime, which is a smaller system for broadcasters. They may only have two or three or four studios. If you want to kind of right-size that, you can get the Telus VX Prime. It's lower priced and appropriate for stations the size of my facility, say in Greenville, Mississippi. All right. This Week in Radio Tech rolls on here. And Brad, so for those of you who don't know Brad Hart, Brad's the director of engineering for Bonneville, here in the Denver market area, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
And Brad, you've been with the stations for quite a while, even through an ownership change or so.
Yeah, a couple of them.
Yeah, yeah. A couple changes.
Yeah, Lincoln Financial and Jefferson Pilot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to date me, I'll just keep dating.
So it's Bonneville now. Before that, it was Lincoln Financial. Before right. that, it was Jeff Pilot. Jeff Pilot. That's when I met you.
Yeah.
Back
yeah.
when we were both in high school.
Yeah.
And now, since the last time I saw you here in Denver, you've moved the facility, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
You moved here in, 2006? Okay, so I must have met you in about 2001 or 2 or 3.
Yeah,
yeah. Talk to me about, you know, as director of engineering, you've got a full-time engineer working with you. Yeah?
Is that Gary Nakashima has been with me for, almost 18 years now.
Wow,
so Gary's been here, and a veteran engineer in this market and regionally. So worked at Jones Satellite, radio networks and all that. So Gary comes with a lot of experience.
He would be here today, but he's out fixing something or checking on something.
Yeah.
Brad, I was asking you earlier, It looks like you've got a settled facility here. You've got people that generally care for the equipment. You've got reliable equipment, but you're getting ready to make some changes. You're not affected by any of the TV repacks. You don't have that on your plate like right. many FMs in big cities do. What kind of keeps you busy these days in the engineering field?
Well, I think, certainly just the day-to-day, things of, this doesn't work or that. There's probably more IT-related things that, are problematic today than there were engineering-wise. But, we still do what we can to, keep our facilities as, competitive. And so we've got two big moves for two Class Cs that are here to that we're pulling off this summer. And so we've there's never a dull moment. Believe me.
Moving a Class C, now that's 100 kilowatt. Is this to give you an even better signal over the population you want?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, a site that that has come that wasn't available even 10 years ago has now become available. And, Bonneville is one of those companies that is always looking for opportunities to, make sure that we've remain competitive. And so they were very open to look at new facilities.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So I landed here yesterday, Brad, and that we always talk about Denver's the mile high city. And I walked out of the airport and the first thing I noticed was low humidity, clear skies, and a little bit thin air. Sometimes, when we're let's say we're at home and we're doing something like baking a cake. Right. And once in a while, us guys bake a cake. Maybe you want to surprise the wife or something. Well, and they have a high altitude baking instructions. Now, I understand that high altitude is important consideration for some broadcast gear as well. Probably nothing in this particular room, but at your transmitter site, you've got even thinner air than you have right here. Mm-hmm. How does that affect your operations at a transmitter site?
Well, I think, a couple of things. I mean, we've got one site we're currently at now that the height above sea level is 10,600 feet. So just airflow through the transmitter, things are derated. 20 tons of air conditioning at sea level is, and I'm not an air conditioning expert, but I can tell you it's derated substantially. So 20 tons, even at the mile high city, and then you move it up to 10.6 is
it might
substantially.
Be like the equivalent of 10 tons.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It might be half.
Yeah. So there's a lot of derating there. And then, of course, airflow through the transmitters. And so those are a couple of things that that the transmitter manufacturers have been able to work out, with us. But it's not as plug and play as you'd think at that altitude.
In a market like this, is a water-cooled FM transmitter an attractive option because of air?
Well, I think it's becoming that. I mean, I think we all probably go back to, maybe back in the day when water cooled required all kinds of external, you had to have a water supply and then the, heat exchangers and all that kind of stuff. And it's pretty impressive to me now, like when I go to NAB or whatever and see all the transmitter manufacturers or most of them. Are pretty well self. Sorry, I'm talking with my hands.
It's that's fine. That's fine.
But that all their heat exchanging is done internally in the transmitter, and you don't require a lot of that external stuff outside. And boy, you can get many more kilowatts per box in a water cooled situation than you can, or liquid cooled. Than you can in air. So it'd be something that I would definitely look at in the future.
Now, our TV brethren have been used to water-cooled transmitters for a long time, but still a fair amount of complication. Not too far from Nashville is a shortwave transmitter site, and there's water-cooled Continental transmitters there. But we're going to do an upcoming Torch show with our friend Charles Kinney in Atlanta, Georgia, and he works for Cox in Atlanta, Georgia. He just installed, I believe, a 40 kilowatt Harris water cooled transmitter or Gates Air water cooled transmitter. And he's invited me out to that site to record a show out there, record an interview. And so we're going to do that and look at how that's so helpful to him there, why it was a good option for him. Brad, a few months ago, I got to go to the new One World Trade Center building in New York. Yeah. And all the TV transmitters there are liquid cooled, not water, but they're liquid cooled. And the place is almost as quiet as the studio. In fact, the noisiest thing in the room was a server that was air cooled sitting in a rack.
You know, Kirk, it's true. I just did an article on Workbench about that. And that was the point that was made, was how quiet the transmitter is. You don't even know that it's on the air. So pretty amazing.
Could be, sounds dangerous.
That's true.
Well, and I think too, the footprint is so much smaller now that you can cram, you know, so much more into a much smaller space and get, you know, 40 kilowatts and a pretty amazing, you know, going back, you know, even 20 years ago, what the equivalent space would have been.
Now, just, I guess thinking about the physics involved, even if you did a water cooled transmitter at altitude at a 10,000 foot mountain, you still have to get rid of the heat with the air. This time it's going to be outside, probably. And maybe it's easier. I mean, it's hard to add more fans to a transmitter of physical size. You can only blow so much air through that. But outside with the heat exchanger, I suppose you could add another heat exchanger. You could, you know, divide the work up among an additional heat exchanger. Hey, if guys at Gates Air, if I got this all wrong, I'll need to have you on the show to explain water-cooled transmitters. That might be a good time to get both Charles Kinney and some people from Gates Air on the air to talk about that. Okay. All right. Well, that's it. But just know that just as aircraft, whether it's a helicopter or an airplane, perform much more poorly in terms of, you know, takeoff and landing performance at 10,000 feet, so do anything blowing air like transmitter fan blades. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, Kirk, when I was selling transmitters in Europe, we had a big bid for the Eiffel Tower. And we could not bid because the company did not have any water-cooled or fluid-cooled transmitters. And everything at the Eiffel Tower is water-cooled. They will not have anything else there. And part of it is what you were saying, Brad, is the compactness of everything, keeping it all together and having the higher power, but in a smaller footprint.
So I want to ask Brad, don't give away any company secrets, but I've noticed that the rack or the engineering room here is spotless. You could have a meal right off the floor there. It's absolutely gorgeous. But I did see a lot of audio processing in the racks. And talk to me about the Denver market. What's audio processing like in this market?
Well, I think it's been always very competitive, you know, very loudness driven. I don't know how else to. I mean, I've been in this market for many years, and to date myself, can kind of remember the first AM I was at. We were putting in CRL, you know, which was the up and coming company that was supposed to be the loudest, proudest thing, and it was three boxes that kind of looked like they were built in Ron Jones' garage, and maybe they were, but they were the loudest. You know, so I think Denver's always been, you know,
very competitive.
But now I think there's been a movement for not only being competitive, but also to keep it clean and not just a grungy, irritating sound, you know, that's on. And it's nice to be, you know, part of that, too, where you just don't crank for, you know, maximum smoke and then suffer the results, you know, later.
Are there a lot of HD signals in this market?
I think pretty much there's only one or two that come to mind that are not HD at this point.
Most FMs have HDs. What do you find in terms of uptake from consumers on HD? Because so many new cars now have HD, but do consumers know about it? Do they know how to tune to them? I don't know that there's billboards around town for any HD stations. So what's discovery and uptake like for consumers?
Well, I think the discovery's, you know, been a little slow on the, you know, people discovering it. But I will tell you, we have a, you know, KYGO is a legacy country that's been in Denver for over 30 years now. And I don't know, a few years ago, we launched a Legends channel on HD2. And I will tell you that when it's off, which isn't very often, but if we've got a T1 failure or something like that, we start getting more and more calls as, you know, the years go on, that people are listening to that and wonder what's happened and all that. And I think more and more people are finding it, and it's becoming a little less confusing. But I think there's just so much competition on that dashboard now, because I know even in my vehicle, you know, and I've got a 2016 Tahoe, if I plug anything in, then boy, it just hijacks that, and you're off to, you know, connected radio or something else. And so you got a lot of competition to fight.
Yeah. I know the NAB and broadcasters are you know, obviously trying to persuade auto manufacturers to, you know, don't make me push three buttons to get to the AM radio or the FM radio. Make that, you know, right up front. And that's got to be an interesting conundrum for the car manufacturers, because who knows, they may be getting sweet deals with the satellite providers and others. You know, and when we get, as our cars are becoming more connected, then you've got people, I don't know that they're doing this, but, you know, Spotify could say, hey, put our button right there on the front. We'll give you a cut, you know, and that's pretty attractive. And broadcasters really aren't in a position to give a Ford or Chevy a cut. Uh-huh. So, wow.
Well, I think along with that, if you don't mind, I might just interject just a little bit. You know, there, I think some of the, and I've sat in on some of the white papers, one of the transmitter manufacturers that's proposing is kind of looking to the future about maybe some all digital feeds coming up in the future. I just read in Inside Radio the other day where one of the AMs back on the East Coast is was just granted authority to operate HD only. So I don't think this is a technology that's going to go away. If anything, I see it expanding, and you know, who knows what will happen, you know, in the future, whether there'll be a sunset on the analog signals or not. But I think that's fascinating. I think, you know, when you look at just a spectrum of a single FM, and you've got the possibilities of perhaps putting eight or more full quality, you know, high quality CD quality stations on there in HD. It's kind of like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, this is what our friends at Nautel have demonstrated.
Okay.
I think they,
I could say that.
I realize some of the bit rates are low, but they have demonstrated 15 radio stations on a single FM transmitter, all HD. Right. And we've had, is it Phil Schmidt with Nautel?
Yes.
We've had him on the show to talk about this technology. And, you know, where would this be useful? Well, maybe in a fairly isolated village where a broadcaster wants to provide a variety of signals off of one tower, one transmitter. And of course, everybody that wants to listen to it would have to have an HD radio that was capable of tuning all these different things, decoding them. Right. But that's just a matter of software.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that Nautel demonstrated too was what they were, at least with the scheme they have now, you were able to, with a conventional receiver, you're able to tune, you know, most of those signals anyway. I mean, they had some, I remember one of those maybe a couple of years ago when they used an old Boston Acoustics, you know, receiver, but it was capable of listening to all of those, you know, HD channels. So I think if the receiver technology is there, it's just, you know, now kind of developing and kind of seeing where FM goes at this point in the future.
I want to touch on streaming also. You know, some large broadcasters are really big on streaming. What's Bonneville's position on streaming? You're employed.
We stream.
Yeah.
Stream everything.
And what do you find about, is there anything especially with smart speakers? And I'll tell you, at the Harnack household, my son, bless his heart, doesn't know how to tune a radio, but he can tell she who shall not be named. You know, why did they call it what they did when they, Amazon could have called it the Speaker of the House.
No. Oh, boy. There you go.
But my son can ask for anything, including my own radio stations the Speaker of the House. Are there any interesting considerations that your programming department or your engineering department makes in relation to maybe a Google Home device or an Echo Dot or Echo is going to be the main listening device?
Yeah, for us, I think it's been most mainly programming, you know, that's kind of had to, you know, adopt a new mindset. And, you know, I think we run on most of our stations, liners, promos occasionally that will talk about how to tell that box, you know, what to go to and the proper verbiage and stuff like that, because, you know, I think we found that you have to be very specific, you know, as what you ask for, you know, on that. Yeah. But it's you know, it's definitely something that's out there. It's well listened to. And so we're right on top of all of that.
I could be wrong about this, but our own experimentation with my own radio stations, both in the U.S. and on the mainland, in Mississippi and in Hawaii and in American Samoa, obviously your call letters are exclusive. If you ask for, hey, Echo, play KHKU FM, well, you're going to get our station in Hawaii.
Right.
If you ask for, hey, Echo, play Star 94.3, it appears that there is some geo information that Amazon knows where you are, where you're asking from, unless you're on a VPN, and they will find you the nearest station that goes by Star 94.3.
Interesting.
Yeah, because we've had at that station, we have partners involved in the station literally from all over the country. And some of them, if they ask for Star 94.3, they get ours in Hawaii. Some of them don't. They get a different Star 94.3. Now, if obviously you've asked for the call letters, you get the station. So we're starting to think that maybe Amazon is geolocating stations to that. Maybe they're not that sophisticated. If you know, maybe you can let us know with some feedback here on the show and see if that seems to be true.
Well, as John mentioned earlier, we were talking about call letters and stuff here. We have a KOSI here, but in this market, it's been known as Cozy for a long time. We found early on that if you told Echo, for instance, or the other one, you know, play Cozy, well, you could wind up with, you know, 10 different, you know, stations, because there's lots of Cozies around the country. So we've had to, you know, just have that mindset that you had to be very specific, you know, as to what you asked.
Or what I usually get is, here's a selection of Cozy music from Amazon Music.
Yeah.
No, not what I wanted.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah.
And maybe I should point out, it may not be Amazon that's doing the geolocating. It may be TuneIn, because unless there's a skill that knows your station, Amazon seems to pass every request over to TuneIn, and then TuneIn determines where you are, because they've been given the IP address, obviously, and the request. So maybe it's actually TuneIn that's making that decision.
Yep.
I don't know. Okay, well, I just think that as engineers, I'm about to write a couple of articles on how to improve time spent listening on smart speakers, and what should you do for your audio processing to either make the experience better on a smart speaker, or at least not mess it up. Mm-hmm. You know, don't do something that's going to make it bad on a smart speaker. So watch for those articles coming out in the next few days. Or so.
And, you know, Kirk, that's really important too for stations like AMs that have low power at night to be able to stream and people are able to pick those signals up and listen regardless of where they are and regardless of what the power is.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm sorry, Brad, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, not only that, but in our case and others in this market, we've put those signals on an HD2 channel or an HD3 channel so that, you know, that if you've got a very restrictive nighttime directional, as we do, it's available 24/7 on a full power FM and is listenable through that whole area.
Whether you have a smart speaker or not, right?
Yes, even just on your HD receiver.
On the HD receiver.
And we do mention that on the air. And when people call and say, oh, I can't hear you at night, you know, after sunset, it's like, no. You have an HD radio, then tune over to blah, blah, blah.
So, or probably the stream.
Have a stream, absolutely.
By the way, we're at the facilities, if you haven't guessed, we're at the facilities of Bonneville International Radio here in Denver. And we're in the studio that's normally used for sports radio 104.3. The Fan, right? So that's obviously an FM sports station, but do you have an AM sports as well?
We have 1600 KEPN, which is ESPN programming.
Yes, all right.
That's correct. But that's kind of the reference to the restrictive nighttime directional that most of, and I'm looking off this way because Aurora is out my left here, and unfortunately there's just such a huge portion of the metro area that, you know, 50 years ago when the station was licensed, it wasn't a big deal. It was all agricultural. Now it is a big deal, but that same signal is available on HD2 on 104.3, 104.3. So we've got that plus the stream. So, and we do have, we do drive listeners from that.
That's really great. So,
I'm going to demonstrate my very poor show prep here. Brad, do you have one or two transmitter sites that are, let's say, challenging or fun to get to?
I think he means driving.
Well, of course.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, if you can hang on through the break, okay. We're going to hear Brad's going to tell us a story, I hope, about one of his difficult transmitter sites. We're in the Mile High City, and there's, as he said, there's transmitter sites that are more than 5,000 feet higher than where we are right now.
Yep.
So that means the car has to end up going 5,000 feet another mile up. So it can be quite a ways. Hey, you're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, our weekly podcast, our weekly show about radio technology. And I want to talk to you about one of our sponsors and a product from our friends at Henry Engineering. And I think I have lost. Oh, here it is. Here's the page. It is the Henry Engineering Sportscaster. Now, this is, you are just in time to get this product, to get this little sportscaster box for your fall sports, high school sports, college sports, because, you know, that football season comes up quickly in August, seems to get earlier every year. And those guys are out there playing. You got your sponsor sold. You want to get the game on. And you want it to sound good. I mean, don't shout into a telephone somewhere. By golly, get a real sports kit. Well, the sportscaster is the missing link in sports radio and video cast audio management. It's used with Henry Engineering Sports Pods to create an integrated system. Now, have you seen the Henry Engineering Sports Pods? They're cool. They sit one in front of every one of your talent, you know, the play-by-play person, the color person, a field spotter, somebody who's keeping, you know, careful track of the score. You have a sports pod in front of them. They can talk. They can adjust their, obviously, their headphone volume. They can listen to, chatter from a producer. It provides isolated headphone outputs for announcers, field reporters, camera operators, if you have those, if you're videoing your games, and the producer. It mixes, now this Henry Sportscaster mixes talent mics and three other audio sources. So if you've got, of all things, a cassette deck, or maybe you've got a digital recorder that you've been using to get, coaches' comments before the game, maybe at halftime, and then even after the game, you know, send that field spotter down to the locker room, get the coaches' comments, and bring them back, then you can put those right on the air. The Henry Sportscaster includes comprehensive intercom and talkback systems for everybody that's involved, and it's ideal for school sports video webcasts. So if you're going to do that, hey, back in the day when I was the local AV lackey, I had a black and white camera and an open reel videotape machine, and I would video the football games, actually, and the basketball games. But you know what? When I started, I had a black and white film movie camera that we used with little film reels that we did.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh yeah. It was 1 year of that. That was about enough of that. Well, Henry Engineering introduces the Sportscaster. Check it out at Henry Engineering, Henry Eng. That's Henry ENG. HenryENG.com is the website. You need to check this thing out. The Henry Sportscaster, pretty amazing gear. And you know, if you really want to find out about it, the place to go is Broadcasters General Store, because Broadcasters General Store brings you this announcement about Henry and the Sportscaster, and their website is even easier than henryeng.com. It's BGS, as in Broadcasters General Store, BGS.cc. BGS.cc, five little letters and a period will get you there. And I tell you what, I really enjoy doing business ordering from Broadcasters General Store. The Shute family and the Kirsten family, just amazing, wonderful people. And not only are they good folks who take care of things, but they have actually been working for something like 20 plus years to finely tune their internal computer systems and ordering systems. They can tell you what's available, when it's going to be available, how soon it'll ship to you, and their prices. I gotta tell you what, you can't beat them.
Can't beat them.
It's amazing. I mean, I've called them and said, I can get this for so-and-so from eBay. They said, oh, we can beat that. No problem. So yeah. if you need audio gear, microphones, audio processing, anything you need, call these folks at Broadcaster General Store or visit their website at bgs.cc and check out the Henry Sportscaster. That is a cool, cool box. All right. Are we done with that? I think we're done with that. Yeah, the Henry Sportscaster. Okay. So we're back This Week in Radio Tech, episode 404, with John Bissett, Brad Hart. I'm going to hold Brad on, if you will, for a couple more minutes, and then we're going to get to John Bissett and some workbench items. Brad, I want to hear a story or something about these transmitter sites that are just way up there in the mountains, and you've got snow and ice and abominable snowmen and all kinds of danger. Yeah. Tell me about an exciting place.
Well, I have to be very honest with you. There are so many of those that go back, you know, so many years that I'll just say this, that part of our kit, we have two engineering vehicles that both Gary and I carry as standard equipment with us probably from October on, our snowshoes, winter boots, parka, you know, all of that, because there are just a lot of places. I mean, frankly, you know, the snow removal around here in the city is great as you get into the mountains. CDOT, all those folks do a great job. But frankly, you're getting into remote places that you know, you've got to wait a couple of days for them to plow out. And in 2003, we ended up with at the site that's at 10,600 feet, Denver got a blizzard and ended up with probably a little over 36 inches of snow. But up there, we had 10 feet.
Of snow?
Yes. Whoa. It was up to and the caretaker's house, his deck is 10 feet above the snow. So he literally would just walk out, because we had a couple of breakers that were tripping, and our transmitter building is the one next door. We couldn't get to the site. I mean, you couldn't get anywhere close to it, snowshoes or anything else. But I remember the caretaker at the time would just literally walk out on his deck, walk out on the snow, and then he had to tunnel in down to the door, because the snow was taller than the door. So he had to tunnel in,
yeah,
and then get the key and go in, you know, reset breakers or whatever, you know, needed to be done. So those are the 100-year snowstorms, but that's the one. Those are ones that, you know, easily remind you of, you know, the conditions here. So we just carry that. We've had to walk into several of our sites over the years. Thankfully, that amount of snow, because you just can't get there. And of course, you're kind of like the utility lineman. Things don't go south until, you know, you got really bad weather,
kind of weather,
you know, and all of that. And then all of a sudden, your evening's kind of interrupted with, you know, got breakers tripped or, you know, whatever, and you got to get up there.
Tell me about how reliable is commercial power, and is it overhead or underground? And then what do you have for generators in that?
All of our sites have generators, typically 150-kilowatt generators that will keep transmitters at full power, air conditioning, all of that. So all of our sites have that. And I have to say, even the sites, even our mountain sites, they do an excellent job of tree removal along the right-of-ways, because that's the biggest issue.
Really?
In the springtime, we get the spring and fall are the worst times, because you get these really heavy spring snowstorms that weigh down the branches of the big pine trees or whatever, and then fall over into the power lines, or they weigh the power lines down. So all in all, it's power reliability has been great. Utilities up there are above ground. There's, you know, so you got to clear the trees every few years, you know, up there. And some of these three phase feeds are coming from many, many miles, you know, away. So, you know, there's lots of things that can go wrong.
Are any of these sites fed from two directions? I guess they're not big enough to support that kind of thing.
No, right? Unfortunately not. If you lose that, you're over on generator. And typically we keep, we share one site with a public service, a public safety agency. Mm-hmm. So we keep 3 days of fuel at most of our sites, so that we at least, we've got a fighting chance to get up there with a fuel truck or something if we needed to add fuel. Yeah.
I would think 3 days could go by pretty quickly if you get 10 feet of snow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Brad, what do you do to keep the fuel from going stale?
Well, we have a check annually, first of all, and then they recommend some fuel additives.
Okay.
But to be honest with you, you know, I'm not going to say we'll burn through it, but we test those generators weekly, sometimes with without load. So we don't keep fuel in there. It's not like we have thousands of gallons. We have hundreds of gallons versus thousands. So it's a little easier to keep that from going stale, you know, with some additives and keep the water out of it. So far.
And when you test them, how long do you test them? your once a week test. Is it like for a half hour, for an hour?
Hour.
An hour. Okay.
Go for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. We take keeping our stations on the air, take that very seriously. And whether it's, you know, with, you know, generators or air chains or whatever, we have redundant systems throughout. And we're fortunate to have that.
You mentioned earlier T1 lines. And I guess some of your STLs are T1. Mm-hmm. Are they all? Or do you have any microwave 450 or what do you do?
Yeah, well, funny you ask. We've got T1s. We have conventional 950 microwave. And then we also have 5.8 gigahertz licensed link. Mm-hmm. Because we have one site that frankly never had. It has commercial power, but the telcos never felt there was any reason to put that up there. So we provide everything up there, from phone lines to internet to all of our connectivity goes on this 6.8 or 5.8 radio system.
Wow. That's a different world than in Nashville, Tennessee, or Greenville, Mississippi, or up where you live.
And you know, Kirk, I was just thinking for the new engineer who may be taking over a station, just knowing, okay, there's a generator there. Do I need to test it? Yes, you do. This weekly test that Brad talks about is really important because these are your backups. When they're not there to back you up, then you're really in hot water. So don't neglect the maintenance. Don't neglect the weekly test. And do you have a means of knowing that the generator test has taken place and is has been satisfactory?
Yeah, absolutely. We bring back status, you know, from those generators that not only tell us when it's running. So at 9 a.m. every Monday, we better get, you know, a status back from the site that says, you know, the generator is exercising. And then also when the generator is running on emergency and it's online, and then when it's off. So we kind of can gauge how much fuel, you know, we burned and all that. So very important to monitor that. But as you were talking, not only maintenance, but rodent infestation. Mm. And we had a situation not too long ago where a pack rat decided to move in. I don't know how prevalent.
It wasn't me.
Well, this guy was
a little smaller, huh?
Well, a little smaller, but boy, what a mess. You know, he made with, or she, whatever, but dragged all of this stuff. Bits of metal and hardware and nuts and bolts and screws and just all kinds of junk. The thing in these nests, because this, I don't know how prevalent pack rats are throughout the country, but this thing made a nest that was,
it was big.
That big, you know, you know, probably a good foot in diameter, and it was a big headache, you know, to get in and, you know, get that cleaned out, because generator people won't clean that out. When they come and see that, it's like, we're not going to touch that. You need to clean it out. Once we got it cleaned out, I went down to Home Depot and got just like commercial weather stripping, because we've put these in enclosed enclosures up there, so people, you know, to minimize vandalism. But there were gaps at the bottom that were probably 2 inches. So put that stuff up there so they couldn't crawl in. We put copper. Steel wool.
Even made of copper.
So it wouldn't, so it doesn't rust, you know, out in the elements.
Yeah.
And you know what? After probably close to 3 years, we've been successful in keeping the little booger out and all that. But they can do massive amounts of damage, very expensive. And then you go to the generator, you got nothing.
And I guess the attractiveness of the generator is probably some warmth.
Warmth, because it's
got a heater in there.
Yeah, there's a block heater that, you know, runs year-round.
Yeah.
And the temperature gets down, whatever it is for the engine, that thing warms up. And it's like, this is home.
I wonder, instead of being so mean to this rat, you could build it a little house,
put a little light bulb in there
to keep it warm. Yeah, give it a supply of junk from your junk drawer, you know.
I'll put that in the suggestion box.
There you go. Have you ever tried using mothballs?
Yeah, we have. And in fact, Gary was reading one of your more recent, you know, workbench things about that. And he did. So we have that in there. But we've really, truly found that the best way is just to block you know, because it's surprising how small of a hole a mouse can get through. And so we've used a combination of hardware and mothballs to try to keep them
out. That's good. Well, yeah. It's kind of funny. Today, earlier, we did a presentation for a group of engineers, and Kirk mentioned the mothball means of repelling mice and rodents and things, and then added, someone made a comment, well, I don't like the smell of the mothballs. Yeah. And Kirk said, well, I like the smell of, what was it?
Jet fuel.
So that's, I guess it depends what you like. If you want the roaches or the mice and snakes in there, or you put up with the mothball smell. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, they can cause some serious damage. Some serious damage and cost you a ton of money.
So you haven't always had microwave links going there. I mean, 5.8 gig, right?
It's 6.
We
had unlicensed 5.8, and then finally had to go to license 6.8.
Yeah. So but that's an IP link, yeah? So you can bring data up and down, VoIP phones, that kind of thing, if
you
want.
Yeah, actually, we run the way these radios are set up are E1s.
Okay,
so we've got that connectivity, four channels over the E1s, you know, going up there. So we provide our own phone service, LAN data. We have Interplex shelves up there that running off the E1s. So we, you know, all program audio, and then that's backed up by a 950 STL.
Do any of your sites have weather cams or security cams that you can remote into?
We're getting more and more into the security, just because of all the break-ins and all that, and the copper thefts. So, yeah, I can't say all of them have them, but we're heading that direction most assuredly.
I've been doing some of that at a couple transmitter sites, and just really seen some value there. There's a curiosity that, I mean, it's kind of fun to go look in on a place, especially a place you're familiar with. And have some inside the building, look at the transmitters. Not that you can exactly read the meters, although I did see, I saw at an SBE meeting recently of somebody wanting to, I know what it was. It was, they had a pressure gauge on the nitrogen, and they, for some reason, did not buy that gauge by what the company, Fartronics. Remember that?
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh.
They didn't buy that. They put a video camera right up close, and then they had a light on it, you know, from a little utility light. So they could actually read the pressure gauge remotely.
No calibration required, right?
That's right. That's right. No calibration required. Maybe they were looking at both the supply and the, you know, the line pressure, the supply pressure and the line pressure. So they could see both at the same time. But that was a pretty unique use for a camera.
Yeah, we haven't gone to the camera for dehydrator, but some of the newer Andrew, you know, dehydrators actually have. And I'm not sure if they're standard or those are optional, but they do have contact closures coming out that if the pressure drops below 3 pounds, we usually keep 5.5. It'll give you a closure on the remote. And again, you know, pretty important to, you know, keep those lines charged.
So my station in Mississippi, when we every few years we'll get some ice, and of course that wreaks havoc because we don't have heated elements and we typically don't have radomes in Mississippi. You must deal with that every winter, right? Ice and snow buildup.
We have ice at the site that's about 6,800 feet. That is the one that's subject, because it's kind of in that layer where it gets really moist and it's cold.
Yeah.
The site at 10.6
dry, right?
Is dry. Yeah. And we have radomes on there, but rarely have any type of buildup on that just because of the elevation. But the medium elevation one really gets iced up. But that one's got heaters on it, and most of the time it keeps, you know, that up. But you know, there are times it gets built up, but you know, thankfully you know, today's transmitters are smart enough to sense that, cut throttle back power a little bit. So they don't burn up any, you know, output stages. But you got to have some.
Do you have any sites where you have a master antenna and you're biplexing several stations together?
Well, we're moving to that right now as we speak. It's we will be the fourth station on this master antenna.
Wow.
So
that's kind of that may not be a new thing in your overall experience, but is that new for Bonneville here in Denver?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. We were all on, we don't want to call them standalone sites. You know, we had one shared, but, you know, right now the biggest combined we have is two stations. We never had four. This one's certainly capable of going and having more stations on it. But for us here, it's a much different, you know, thing, and having a huge room full of combiners and all of that.
Now, Brad, will you be keeping your auxiliary site then for those stations as backup?
Yeah.
Okay.
We maintain backup on all the FMs at this point. So yeah, we'll keep those.
Good.
Because you never know.
Well, that's it. Again, thinking for the new engineer, when you replace a piece of equipment, if the piece of equipment that you're replacing can be used as a standby, you know, you're giving yourself a little bit of insurance that if the main piece of equipment goes down, you've got something to fall back on. So,
and that's why I still have a Gates Level Devil at the station.
And it works.
I know it doesn't work.
Sorry, I'll buy it from you.
Or some tube-type cart machine.
You're gonna tell us you got a stay level, too.
Stay level, too. Yeah. That's right.
So, Brad, I'm so glad. Thanks for sticking with us a bit longer, because I keep thinking of questions. So, to me, geographically, the Denver market's pretty interesting, because you've got this area here where Denver is that's reasonably flat right here. And then you've got these mountains just a few miles, you know, to the west, really high. So you put a tower there on the mountain ridges that are overlooking Denver, right? Mm-hmm. And Denver and Boulder and this whole area. Mm-hmm. You cover that great. What is there to cover on the backside? Is there population there at all? Are you worried about that at all?
To be honest, no. Yeah. No. I mean, there's a lot of ski traffic and stuff,
right,
you know, that goes up there that's pretty seasonal and stuff like that. I can tell you the master antenna we're on now, boy, it is really pulled in. You know, that lobe is strictly out over the Denver metro area, and it is just pulled in tight as a drum, you know, to the west. Because there's couple of things that happen. You get all that signal going back there. You get a lot of multipath because you got a lot of stuff higher back behind you that has a lot of reflections.
Oh,
so that's not really what you're after either.
That doesn't help in the Denver. We have reflections coming.
You get those reflections coming back here.
Yeah. So most everybody is pretty well, you know, kept that, you know, signal, you know, coming east, and that's pretty much it.
What about AM stations in the Denver market? You know, the bigger stations, where do they tend to put their towers? Right here in town or out a bit? Where?
Yeah, of course, a lot of those are really established, have been around for a long time, because it's, you know, it's kind of that, you know, that movement that's been around for probably the last 20, 30 years, not in my backyard.
I was going to say, now there are a lot of communities that are built around those sites. Right?
Okay.
So you look at, you know, the iHeart, you know, the KOAs, the big blow torches that have been around. Well, you know, I worked there back longer than I care to admit for a while. But when I was out there, it was farmland. And now there's like a Home Depot. You can throw, you know, and you're kind of thinking, well, how can you get a, you know, you must have RF, you know, just light the, you know, fluorescent fixtures. But so many of those areas, even RAM back then was so remote back there that there was no housing areas, but everything is just built up crazy now around everybody. And there's very little place to go unless you're going to pull up stakes and move that thing far out of Denver.
Wow.
I can't think of an AM move around here for a long time. It's been a long time.
That's similar to, I was at WSB in Atlanta on, what was it, Tuesday? I was there, yeah.
Yes.
Tuesday.
Yes.
And we had a cookout there for some of the engineers in the area. And their tower used to be out in farmland, way outside of Atlanta. And now it's a shopping center right around the tower. Yeah. And of course, there over the years have been plenty of RF problems. And the engineers at WSB, I mean, apparently when you sign a lease at this shopping center, you acknowledge that there is a lot of RF here and your phones or whatever, your PA speakers. Wow. And if you just do what we say, it'll be okay. But, yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Oh, that's neat.
Wow.
So, hey, we're going to take a break and be right back with a final word from John Bissett. And he hasn't gotten a word in edgewise.
We've talked about rodents and keeping and mothballs, the smell of mothballs. Yeah. So, no, we've done some fine things. When we do get back, I'd like to talk about Brad's start in broadcasting.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Okay. So this is fascinating. Stick around. We're going to hear from our friends at Lavo, and we'll be right back. Hang on.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
And thanks a lot to our friends at Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Sure appreciate their help. And so we're here with John Bissett, my colleague from Telos, and also he's the author of the Workbench
column. Wow. Yes.
Yeah. The Radio so World. We've got a great tip from John coming up, and we're spending our few more minutes with Brad Hart, the director of engineering for Bonneville International here in Denver, Colorado, with a beautiful facility here. It's really great. Although I understand you're going to be putting in some new gear in the next year or so.
We're headed that direction.
So we wanted to know how Brad got started because it's fascinating. Well,
from the Workbench column, I go back, for those of you that haven't seen it, they were doing some telephone line work, and the old telephone splicing tents were up in the air. And it reminded me of when I was a kid, that was one of the things that sparked me into, you know, you see the guy crawling up the tower with the spikes on, or up the phone pole with the spikes on his feet. And then he disappeared into this tent for the rest of the day. And it's like, man, what's going on in there?
Wait a minute. You thought, I can go camping and do electronics at the same time.
Absolutely. That's right.
And climb poles.
So we've gotten, after mentioning that, I just mentioned, you know, that was one of the things that kind of moved me into wanting to be in broadcasting. And I've asked readers, what do you think? So I asked Brad, and I want him to share his story because it's pretty cool.
Well, And when you asked me earlier about an hour ago, it kind of got the old wheels turning because they don't turn quite as fast as they did. But I got to thinking that, you know, one of the very first thing was that my mom had got me a walkie-talkie. It was a 3-transistor super hit receiver. And for those who may not know what a super heterodyne receiver, it covered pretty much the entire CB band. And so any signal that was there, you heard it. And it transmitted on one channel, but received everything. So I was pretty fascinated, you know, about that. But then she took that one step further, I think, and saw that fascination. It got me an older Heathkit. And again, if you don't know Heathkit, look it up. But it was she got me it was a GR91 four-tube vacuum tube, not transistor, four vacuum tube receiver that was a shortwave. And I got to tell you, I was fascinated by the fact that I could be an armchair traveler and sit and visit places every night, during the day that I probably never visit. I've never visited before. That was during the Cold War. So I could listen, you know, behind the Iron Curtain to Radio Free Europe, a lot of those places that, you know, radio was kind of verboten and very, a lot of times jammed. And that kind of took me on into amateur radio, which I still am after many years absence, was relicensed in an amateur extra class now, and have been for about the last 10 years. But that just was fascinating to me that, you know, that how radio worked. And so I built my own Part 15, by the way, AM and FM, you know, I had one on 670 kilohertz AM and whatever frequency was available, you know, back then for FM. And just, I just loved the whole concept of that. And got, you know, when I got my first job in radio, I thought I had the world by the tail.
So, isn't it neat?
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so that was it.
That's really neat.
And I still enjoy that.
My radio or my transmitter was a Lafayette that I figured out, okay, it goes down the end of the block with a 6-foot wire. Yep. If I put a 100-foot wire and string it over to the garage, it'll cover
two or three.
but it's really neat. Kirk, how about you?
I didn't really have an interest in broadcasting, in pirate broadcasting or part 15.
You were a pirate?
at that age, and the really short story is, and someday we'll go over it if anybody's interested. But the really short story is, I wanted to, I had an interest in electronics. I like making lights flash and motors move and even more. And I built some Heathkits. I built a shortwave receiver. It was a solid state one, but this would have been in about 1973. Right. I built a Heathkit and like a 4-band shortwave. Mm-hmm. And I built a Heathkit calculator, a 4-banger, you know, plus, minus, divide, multiply. And a couple other Heathkits. I'd never built a television. I guess Dad didn't trust me enough to buy a television that I was going to build. I ordered electronic parts and made just little things. Well, but I really wanted to be on the radio. I wanted to be behind a microphone. But here's the weird thing. I wanted to be on the radio because I couldn't. And I couldn't because when I was in up to about my mid-teens, I had a speech impediment. I stuttered profoundly. I mean, I couldn't say my name, and I'm not exactly sure how I overcame that, or if it was me that did it, or just growing out of it, or whatever. I know there's a lot of people who are, I think they call it now disfluency. They don't call it stuttering so much, but because I wanted to do what I couldn't do, and somehow I got involved with University Productions of television at Eastern Kentucky University, where my dad taught. And then I got hooked. I got hornswoggled into running the board on the radio station while the jazz DJ that night went and saw his girlfriend at the girls' dorm. So that's how I got into it. I was hornswoggled.
There you go. Oh, that's great. That's great.
But yeah, I had an interest in the electronics. And what was interesting to me is that the other board operators wanted to show me, like, how do I get the game? You know, we were the flagship station for EKU football team. How do you get the game on there? Well, you push this patch in, you throw that switch, and the game will be there. Well, that wasn't good enough for me. I went, well, why will it be there? What does that do? And nobody knew. I had to go get the engineer out of the TV department and say, they told me I had to do this, 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 and this. And what's happening? And so the engineer could tell, well, this kid's interested. I'll tell, and, well, this connects from this, and this wires over to here. And so I began to understand why things did the way they did. And that, to me, was fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
That's really neat.
Well, you know, one other thing, too, back then, and I think probably John can address this, too, is that when I got into broadcasting and even just playing around, pirate or not, but you had to build a lot of your own stuff because you couldn't find a lot of this stuff that was off the shelf. Thankfully, you got the folks, you know, that you were just mentioning, Henry Engineering, who's made all kinds of wonderful widgets and things that you wish you'd had, and Radio Design Labs that has done that too. But you had to build. If you needed a this or a that, or if you needed impedance matching or however you needed to do that, you typically had to deal with that, you know, yourself, which, you know, I think today you're lost a lot from that because you don't have the time and you don't have the resources. There's so many things going on. You don't have the time to sit down at a workbench and spend, you know, 2 or 3 days building a this or that. And so I'm, you know, to be honest, you know, my interest in electronics and all that, I don't regret a minute of that, because you can, you know, if you can't find it, you can probably build it.
And you can, and nowadays you can Google a circuit if you're not quite sure what to do. Although I must say, I'm disappointed in my own self for this reason. If I had to solve a little logic problem, okay, if this comes on, that comes on, this comes on, I want to do this. Yeah. Of course, a lot of kids, they would solve that with an Arduino. Mm-hmm. You know? Now, what I should do is solve that with some logic gates, you know, TTL, logic, some CMOS logic gates. Yep. That's what I should do based on my coming up through the world of electronics. But honestly, maybe I didn't learn that stuff well enough, and it's kind of left me. I'd go get some relays, you know, and that's a plan C, which unfortunately is often my plan A. Well, my plan A is to figure out how do I do it with audio over IP and control and Ethernet, you know, because now so many of the things that we used to build little boxes for, as we used to call them bud boxes, now so many of those functions, if you just build out the audio, the networking infrastructure that different companies have, certainly one of our sponsors here, Telos, you can get done, you know, most of what you need to get done with that. So, yeah, you still need a Henry Engineering super relay box to light the light. But now maybe you're lighting a string of LEDs and your current is only 200 milliamps instead of, you know, at 12 or 5 volts instead of, you know, lighting
200 watts.
So, yeah, it's a different world we're getting into. Still important to know the fundamentals or know where to find them.
But that's why John's column is good, you know, too, because we read that every time it comes out, because it's just, it's very valuable. I don't care whether you've been in the business like I have for decades or you're just starting out. There's just a lot of good, you know, got a lot of good common sense. And I found over the years that common sense gets you a lot of, you know, a lot of places here. And so we always appreciate, you know, everything.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Look forward for some suggestions from you. So that'll be good. Yeah. But, you know, and that's one of the things we were talking today about, tips that that people have. I think probably one of the most popular was labeling circuit breakers. We talked about the safety aspect of that, that even inside your circuit breaker box, where the panel box, where you've got, you know, 20 breakers, individually labeling each one of those so that if there's an emergency, you don't have to look at that hand scribbled legend that's inside the box that you can't read anymore, but you know exactly where the breaker is. You can find it very quickly. So there's a plug for the Brother P-Touch labeler. Those things are really, really invaluable. So anyway, but thank you very much. I enjoy doing the column, and for those of you that aren't aware of it, it's radioworld.com, and then just search for Workbench. It's the Workbench column.
And, yep, great column. You've asked good. Are you in there every other issue?
No, every issue.
Every issue.
Twice a month.
I'm sorry, I only read every other one, so I've missed half of them, actually.
That's why he's getting so many good tips.
We got to have you back on again. We tend to have you on every couple of years or so. Exactly. We got to make it, you know, a little more often than that.
That would be fun. All right. Very good.
And Brad, since I haven't seen you, what, in 15 years, we got to get together more often.
We do. But it's been great having you both here and, you know, having a chance to catch up and chit chat and all that. So it's been great.
It's been great
for us. Thank you for your hospitality. This has been great.
I want to thank our sponsors, the folks at Lavo, the folks at Henry Engineering through Broadcasters General Store, and my friends at the Telos Alliance, makers of the VX multi-studio, multi-line phone system and the VX Prime. Appreciate all of their help. Also, I appreciate very much our producer, Suncast. He's always right on. I guess switching today's show is a little bit easy. We had one camera, but thanks very much, Suncast. I really appreciate you being there. Great job. And also thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where lots of other fine podcasts are found as well. Tell your friends, please, about This Week in Radio Tech. You know, we have a YouTube page. Just look for This Week in Radio Tech on YouTube. And if you subscribe, then you'll get automatically notified on your cell phone, on your device, whatever it is. You'll be notified that, hey, there's a new episode of This Week in Radio Tech. And so that's a great way to keep up with it. And a place where all your usual podcasts are found, you can find us there as well. So thanks again for being with us. We're live in Denver. I'm headed home. John, you're here tomorrow. You've got a picnic tomorrow.
SBE picnic. Yeah. You're coming to that as
absolutely.
Well?
Absolutely.
Very good. Yeah. Very good.
We'll look out, chapter 48.
There you go. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that'll be fun.
We'll take pictures of the food for me.
Absolutely. Very good. Will do.
And then the local guys here we saw today, they made a trip to the National NIST?
Right. The timing folks, right?
They saw the cesium clock. That sits there at almost 0 degrees Kelvin.
You know, you're going to have to come back here and do a couple of more shows because there's a lot of technology here that you never thought about in Denver. I mean, I'm amazed. There's WWV up in Boulder,
right?
And then NIST and, a lot of things to keep you busy.
I heard WWV is going to start going to do the PPM thing on. So they,
they need a Voltaire.
Yeah. All time, all the time. All right, folks, we got to go. You take care and catch us next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
So long.